Okay. I'm Joshua Howard. I'm also a member of the New States Organizing Committee. I'd like to introduce Andrew Kleiman, who's also a member of the New States Organizing Committee, one of the founders. He is a professor of economics at Pace University, and he has written both this pamphlet, which was published in Historical Materialism, an article published in the journal Historical Materialism, and it's available in pamphlet form here for $2. It marks this concept of intrinsic value on the unity of value fetishism and the analysis of capitalist production in Capital. And most recently, Reclaiming Marxist Capital, Refutation of the Myth of Inconsistency. There are copies available for $22, I think?
Yeah.
Okay. So $22. And, well, since we're running late, without further ado, Andrew Kleiman.
Thanks very much. Thank you. I want to thank my colleagues at the New Space, members of the organizing committee, and the teachers. Alex is here somewhere, and Bill, who's given talks for us, students like Mike and Kostas and Steve, and especially I want to thank Susie, who proposed this meeting. So that's what gave us, at least me, the idea, the impetus to hold this meeting. I'm going to try so that we have time for questions and comments and a whole lot of discussion. I'm going to try to keep to about 40 minutes. I might go a little bit over, but I'm going to try to sacrifice a lot of things that I might say. Maybe we can pick some of that up as we go along. This talk is partly based on two other articles of mine that just, you know, are available free from these websites. So that latter one, that's on that, if you go to that page, there's a link directly to the article. In the past couple of weeks, there's also grown up a couple of websites that are providing information about the crisis, commentaries about the crisis from a radical or Marxist perspective. I don't have the URLs, but you can Google them. One is called Radical Perspectives on the Crisis, and the other that I know of is called Marx and the Financial Crisis of 2008. Tonight's talk is basically written out and basically ready to go. I want to maybe touch it up a bit, but we're going to try to make that available to folks as soon as possible. So the best thing would be to check the New Space website, www.new-space.mahost.org.
Andrew, those two websites are on the flyer for tonight's talk. Why don't I pass these?
Okay, very good. Very good. Okay. Since we advertised this meeting, recognition that we're in the most serious financial crisis since the Great Depression, recognition of that fact has kind of hit home to everybody. And I want to begin by talking about the word crisis. Marxists are famous for predicting 5 out of the last 3 recessions. So I want to point out what I mean by crisis. I do not mean collapse, and I do not mean a slump, such as a recession, depression, or downturn. We're now, you know, in the worst crisis since the Great Depression. The U.S. is probably in the midst of a recession, but so far it has been a relatively mild one, so far. For instance, payroll employment has fallen 9 months in a row, but the total decline to date is 760,000 jobs in the U.S., and that's well less than half of the decline that occurred during the first 9 months of the last recession in 2001. And that itself was a relatively mild recession. Okay. So when I talk about crisis, I'm not talking about the slump. A crisis is a rupture or disruption in the network of relationships that keep the capitalist economy operating in the normal way. rupture, disruption. And the present crisis is characterized above all by an acute crisis of confidence that loans will be repaid. When they say crisis of confidence, that's what it's about. Confidence that loans are going to be repaid. And this has in turn caused an acute crisis of liquidity. An official at the Boston Fed recently called this a liquidity lock. It's a new term, but I'll be using it. Liquidity lock. It's the inability of businesses to get cash for their short-term day-to-day needs. Okay. Not for expansion, not to, build new factories or whatever, just, to get from one day to tomorrow. General Electric, buys all kinds of supplies and parts and hires workers in order to produce. To do that, they rely on short-term credit. Without short-term credit, the system is going to dry, the system is going to grind to a halt really, really quickly if there is no credit. It's starting to flow in the past several days a lot better than it was. Okay? But some major credit markets have been essentially frozen. It looks like right now, as a result of the bailout and other measures, that's starting to return a bit to normal. Lending has been dropping rapidly or even coming to a halt. And again, the business sector depends crucially on credit. Just to get from today to tomorrow, so the economy would be in danger of just a complete collapse if this situation, liquidity lock, were to persist for any length of time. Now, many liberals and leftists have told us that the $700 billion plus bailout was not needed. Or they said that the bailout was meant to provide windfall profits to the financial industry, or that the money could be spent differently, for instance, to protect homeowners against foreclosure, or to invest in infrastructure, rebuilding the cities, or so forth. But the crisis is much worse than they want you to think when they say that, because they've been focusing on the wrong issues. They're focusing on the slump, the recession, maybe a depression. Okay? But that kind of condition is not yet terribly severe, and that can perhaps be dealt with in many ways. Okay, maybe they're focused on the bank failures and the bankruptcies in the financial sector. But the really acute and immediate crisis, the one that could lead to outright collapse, is the crisis of confidence that has caused the liquidity lock. And I'll try to show you a couple graphs that can illustrate that problem. The liberals and leftists who've sort of said the crisis is not such a great deal, they have proposed no alternative policies to deal with this crisis, the crisis of short-term credit, and that's because if one wants to save the capitalist system, there basically aren't any alternatives that differ, except in detail, from what the Treasury and the Fed and foreign governments now are doing, making the liquidity flow, the cash flow. Especially by the Fed stepping in to become the lender of last resort in the commercial paper market. That's where big, companies that don't need to go to banks, that's how they borrow for their short-term needs. And by the Treasury twisting the arms of the banks to take the bailout money and then turn around and lend it out. And there's a struggle going on about that right now. There's only one alternative to the crisis of confidence and to the liquidity lock that differs from any of this in more than detail. And that's a new human socioeconomic system, socialism. Okay. If you want to save capitalism, there's only basically one way to do it, except you can maybe tinker with the details, and that's what they're doing. I want to illustrate some of what I've been talking about above by looking at a couple of graphs. There just are not decent data on the decline in the volume of short-term lending. That's what I want to know is how much has short-term lending contracted? There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that is basically totally frozen, but what we're forced to look at are interest rate figures. So figure one is the so-called TED spread, and it's the difference between the rate of interest that a bank can get by lending to another bank for 3 months and the rate of interest it can get by lending to the U.S. Treasury for 3 months. Now, here's the point. Lending to the Treasury is safer. So the difference between these two rates, which is the spread, is the difference. Okay, the difference between the rate, interbank lending interest rate, and the rate of lending to the U.S. Treasury is essentially a measure of the willingness or unwillingness to take on risk. Okay. In other words, the extra interest the bank demands before it will take on the extra risk of lending to another bank instead of lending to the U.S. government. That's what this is measuring. And so you see, for the past several months, the TED spread was just basically at one percentage point, and that is already double normal. You know, normally, it's about a half a percentage point. Okay. Then we have the events of the Lehman, you know, going under, AIG being bought up, Wachovia, all of that. The thing just shoots up. Then it comes down slightly, and then it just kept going up and up and up until it was at over 4.5%. And then the latest bailout measures began to come in, the international coordination, the Fed saying it would directly lend in the commercial paper market. And here it came down from over 4.5%. This is, as of the end of the day yesterday, to slightly under 3%. Okay, so it does look, at least for now, that the confidence problem, the fear of taking on risks of lending, have been ameliorated somewhat by these policies already. What would have happened had these bailout measures not happened? You know, we don't know, but I can suspect. Okay, figure two. Okay, let's just look at the bottom one. Yeah. Figure two is the interest rate on 4-week Treasury bills, lending to the U.S. Treasury for 4 weeks. And the rate was about 1.5%, which is, you know, quite low already. Then these are the, again, the same events. Lehman, AIG, all of that. The rate comes down, goes up and up, okay? The latest figure for yesterday is it went up to 0.42, which would be about there. But you see right here, that's 0.05%. Okay, this is about 0.05% for a lot of the past month. So basically, it's hitting zero, and there was even a report at one time it was below zero. Okay, but take this point where it's 0.05%. So if you bought a $10,000 T-bill, okay, 4 weeks later, you would have earned 42 cents interest. Okay. What this means is that because various financial institutions have become afraid to lend to private entities, they have become willing to obtain ridiculously little interest by lending to the U.S. government. Okay. The greater the fear of the private sector lending, the lower the interest rate they're willing to accept on government paper. And so basically this seems to represent a total shift out, especially of the private commercial paper market. Okay. But it is improving, it looks like, as a result of the restoration of some degree of confidence as a result of the latest bailout measures. Okay, now I want to look at what's been coming from some of the left. In the October 27 issue of The Nation, the historian Howard Zinn wrote People's History of the United States. Zinn wrote, "It is sad to see both major parties agree to spend $700 billion of taxpayer money to bail out huge financial institutions that are notable for two characteristics, incompetence and greed. A simple and powerful alternative would be to take that huge sum of money and give it directly to the people who need it. Let the government declare a moratorium on foreclosures and let and help homeowners pay off their mortgages. Create a federal jobs program to guarantee work to people who want and need jobs." Well, that's all well and good. And the measures that Zinn proposes are, of course, things worth fighting for to help working people as the slump in the economy worsens. But how does this address the crisis of confidence and the liquidity lock? The lack of short-term cash just to keep the system moving from day to day. Okay. Of course, you could say, forget trying to restore confidence. Confidence that people will lend and get their money back. Businesses, institutions, lend and get their money back. You could say, forget trying to restore confidence. But that's basically to say, forget trying to save capitalism. But that's not what Zinn said. Now, Barbara Ehrenreich, who I think a lot of people know, a well-known writer and erstwhile revolutionary socialist, said in the Huffington Post on October 1st, quote, "I'm hoping that capitalism survives this one." This is why I say erstwhile revolutionary socialist. "I'm hoping that capitalism survives this one, if only because there's no alternative ready at hand. At the very least, we should get some regulation and serious oversight out of any bailout deal." Okay, so she at least faced the fact that what is on the line is the capitalist system itself, not just incompetent and greedy and huge financial institutions. And then there's the left liberal economist Dean Baker, a member of the Rat Pack. It's a joke for those of you who are old enough to remember. Okay, now Baker is heads a sort of left liberal think tank, or he's half head of it. And he was for the bailout before he was against it. On September 20, he wrote, "There is a real risk that the banking system will freeze up, preventing ordinary business transactions, like meeting payrolls. This would quickly lead to an economic disaster with mass layoffs and plunging output." Okay, that's basically what I've been saying. So then he says, "The Fed and Treasury are right to take steps to avert this disaster. There is an urgency to put a bailout program in place." So that top paragraph is, you know, I think quite right there. Now, 9 days later, he reverses himself, writing in the Guardian website. He says, "The bailout is a big victory for those who want to redistribute income upward. It takes money from school teachers and cab drivers and Joe the plumber. It gives it to incredibly rich Wall Street bankers. This upward redistribution was done under the cover of crisis, just like the war in Iraq, but there is no serious crisis story. Yes, the economy is in a recession that is getting worse, but the bailout will not get us out of the recession or even be much help in alleviating it." Now, portraying the bailout as not a program, portraying the bailout as a program to make the rich richer, Baker is saying that it's not going to alleviate or end the recession. And that's correct. Okay, that is not its purpose. So he says it's going to make the rich richer. It's not going to end the recession. But the purpose is not to end the recession. The purpose is not, however, to make the rich richer. What about the system's need to get the liquidity, the cash, flowing again? Okay, Baker was acutely aware of that 9 days before. So what he says is why there's no serious crisis, later in the article, he says the government could just take over the banks. But how can the government take over the banks? There's only two ways. They can take over the banks by buying the banks, which brings us back to a bailout that costs hundreds of billions of dollars or more, depending on how extensive the nationalization would be. Or the government could take over the banks without compensation. And that's a really lovely way of dealing with a lack of confidence on the capitalist part. And it's a lovely way of getting the credit flowing again. In order to lend, banks, even nationalized banks, have to get the funds to lend. They need people and institutions to lend to them or to invest in them. But I know that I wouldn't want to lend to or invest in any institution that has shown a willingness to expropriate without compensation. And I don't know many people who would. So once again, of course, you could say, forget trying to restore confidence, forget the sanctity of property rights, In other words, forget trying to save capitalism. But Baker didn't go there. Okay, now, I want to turn to the roots of this crisis, going back, oh my God, so, you know, back when I was young. The crisis of the 1970s. My view is basically that the current crisis has its roots in the economic slump of the 1970s, from which the global economy never fully recovered. It never fully recovered in the way in which the destruction of capital in and through the Great Depression and then World War II led to a post-war boom. The destruction of capital gave rise to a post-war boom, as I'll talk about. Okay. Policymakers here and abroad since that time have understandably been afraid of a repeat of the Great Depression. So they've continually taken measures to slow down and prevent the destruction of capital. By which I mean a plummeting of the asset values, the value of the capital, as well as physical destruction of capital, such as took place in World War II. Okay. But see, the destruction of capital is not only the consequence of an economic slump, it's also the mechanism leading to the next boom. For instance, if you have a business that can generate $3 million in profit per year, okay, but the value of the capital that's invested in the business is $100 million, the rate of profit is a measly 3%. But if the destruction of capital values enables a new owner to acquire that business for only $10 million rather than $100 million, the new owner's rate of profit is a more than respectable 3, 10, 30%. And that's a tremendous spur to a new boom. Okay, but such a massive destruction of capital as took place in the Depression and then in World War II has not taken place. And so there has only been a partial recovery in the world economy. And that has been brought about largely through, first, declining real wages after inflation for most workers, as well as other austerity measures, you know, ending welfare as we know it, for instance, and exporting the crisis into the third world, new international division of labor. Secondly, and more to the point concerning what we're dealing with tonight, the partial recovery has been brought about by a mountain of debt, mortgage debt, consumer debt, government debt, corporate debt, to paper over the sluggishness and mitigate the effects of the declining real wages and so forth. Now, because of this excessive run-up of debt, there have been persistent debt crises. And these, what we're in now is basically another debt crisis. There's the savings and loan crisis, the debt crisis of Latin America, early 80s, the debt crisis of, you know, 10 years ago, the currency crisis, just continually. These crises will continue until either, one, sufficient capital is destroyed to once again make investment truly profitable, like in a real boom. The present crisis may end up being that moment. I don't think anybody knows. Or two, you know, we succumb to such a panic, the kind that's been developing, that lending stops, the economy crashes, and that leads to chaos or fascism or warlordism or God knows what. Okay. Or third, capitalism is replaced by a new human socialist society. Okay. Those are the way it's going to go. So according to what I've been suggesting here, financial bubbles are an inevitable result of efforts to grow the economy by means of debt faster than is warranted by the underlying flow of new value that is generated from production. The more sophisticated and widespread the credit markets and, you know, the variety of financial instruments, the greater is the degree to which this forced expansion of the economy can take place. That's a term of Marx, by the way, forced expansion. Okay, but also the greater the degree of the ultimate contraction that takes place when the law of value eventually makes its presence felt. So a bubble is kind of like a rubber band stretching and then snapping back. Now this next one, okay, this depicts what is meant by a bubble. Imagine that demand for assets such as stocks, homes, increases for whatever reason without a corresponding increase in the new value that's being produced. This causes the prices of these assets to rise. People's and businesses' wealth increases on paper. So they now have the means to borrow more. And they become irrationally exuberant, as Greenspan put it. They have the means to borrow more. They might become irrationally exuberant. And all this leads to a further increase in demand, and so on and so forth, until the bubble bursts. Now, the debt-induced bubble that has resulted in the present crisis is, of course, the housing sector bubble. And paradoxically, it came about because of the weakness of the U.S. economy in this decade. First, year 2000, stock prices began to plunge sharply as the prior bubble, the dot-com bubble, in the stock market burst. Then in early 2001, the economy went into recession. It was further weakened by the 9/11 attacks. So in order to allay fears of financial collapse following the 9/11 attacks, the Fed lowered short-term interest rates. And even after the recession ended, a couple of months later, employment kept falling. And it fell into the middle of 2003, so the Fed kept lowering short-term lending rates. For three full years, starting in October of 2002, the real, that is inflation-adjusted federal funds rate, that's bank-to-bank lending rate, was actually negative. That allowed banks to borrow funds from other banks, lend them out, and then pay back less than they had borrowed. Pay back less than you borrowed once you take inflation into account. So this was a cheap money, easy credit strategy. It created a new bubble. With stock prices having recently collapsed, this time the flood of money did not initially go into the stock market, it went into the home mortgage market. Loan funds were so ready to hand that working class people who normally would just have their applications for home mortgages turned down, they were now able to borrow. And so you see this other line here, that is the trajectory of mortgage borrowing as a percentage of after-tax income. Okay. And notice that the trajectory of that is basically a mirror image in this period of the federal funds rate. Okay. That's a clear indication of the close link between the explosion of mortgage borrowing on the one hand and the easy credit conditions on the other. And with the mortgage borrowing increasing so rapidly, the ratio of outstanding mortgage debt to after-tax income, what percentage of people's after-tax income, you know, is the debt, that rose only modestly in the 1990s, okay, but from the year 2000, it jumped and jumped and jumped and jumped all the way into the middle of 2006. Now, it's from like 71% to 103%. The additional money flooding the housing market caused home prices to skyrocket, and in fact, the total mortgage debt and the home prices rose at almost exactly the same percentage in the first 6 years of this decade. Now, those of us who attempt, following Marx, to understand capitalism's economic crises as disturbances that are rooted in its system of production, value production, we always face the problem that the market and production are not linked in a simple cause and effect way. As a general rule, in other words, it's not the case that there's a particular disturbance in the sphere of production that causes an economic crisis. Instead, what occurs in the sphere of production conditions what occurs in the market, and it sets limits to what occurs in the market. Okay. And in this sense, it's indisputable that the U.S. housing crisis has its roots in the system of production. The increases in home prices, basically the increase in the debt, same thing, was far in excess of the flow of value from new production that alone could guarantee repayment of the mortgages in the long run. The new value created in production is ultimately the only source of all income, including homeowners' wages and salaries and so forth. And therefore, that new value created in production is the sole basis upon which the repayment of mortgages ultimately rests. But from 2000 to 2005, the rise in after-tax income was barely one-third of the rise in home prices. So this is precisely why the real estate bubble proved to be a bubble. A rise in the prices or an expansion of credit, they say, oh, well, it's excessive. But it's never excessive in itself. It's only excessive in relationship to the underlying flow of value. You have non-Marxist economists and financial analysts, and they don't maybe like to use the term value. They might use different language to describe these relationships, but they don't dispute what I'm saying. Okay? It's commonplace, in fact, to assess whether homes are overvalued or undervalued by looking at whether their prices are high or low in relationship to the underlying flow of income. Okay? But that's the value from production. Now, some players in the mortgage market did realize that something was amiss with this, you know, big run up here. But they sought to reap quick, lush profits and then protect themselves before the day of reckoning. But also there was a good reason, or what seemed at the time to be a good reason, why others failed to perceive that the boom here was, in fact, a bubble, unsustainable. And that's that home prices in the U.S. had evidently not fallen on a national level since the Great Depression, at least. So it was natural to assume that home prices were just going to keep rising. And this assumption served to allay misgivings over the fact that a lot of money was being lent out to homeowners who were less than creditworthy and in the form of very risky subprime mortgages. So the point is this. Had the home prices continued to go up, homeowners who had trouble making mortgage payments would have been able to get the additional funds they needed to make their payments by borrowing against the increased value of their homes. That was very common. And there would have been no crisis. Even if home prices had leveled off or fallen, but only fallen slightly, there probably would have been no crisis. In light of the historical record, the credit rating agencies assumed as their worst case scenario that there would just be, you know, a modest dip in home prices. And it's because of that assumption that they gave high ratings to a huge amount of pooled and repackaged mortgages, mortgage-backed securities, which included subprime mortgages and so forth. And today that's all called toxic. Very few investors are willing to touch it. But if the credit rating agencies had been right about the worst case scenario, just a modest decline in home prices, the investors who thought that they were buying safe investment-grade securities would indeed have reaped a decent profit. Okay, but what we now know is that the bond raters were wrong, you know, massively wrong. And so we've had a massive mortgage crisis. According to the latest figures, this is from the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, between the peak in 2006, July 2006, and July of this year, 2 years later, U.S. home prices have fallen by 19.5%. Okay, that's not a modest dip. And that is at the root of all of this, a tremendous bursting of a bubble. And because you had these mortgage-backed securities, mortgages pooled and resold, the mortgage market crisis has spread throughout the financial system and become a generalized financial crisis. Okay, now, I want to say a bit about who or what is to blame. You know, from Zinn and others, we hear a lot about greed. But capitalists are always greedy. Okay, we don't always have a massive crisis, however. So what explains the fact that at this particular moment, we do have a crisis? It's not greed, they're always greedy. There's also a lot of talk about lax regulation and insufficient regulation. And among the people who've been putting out this idea is Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winner in economics, former chief economist at the World Bank. And I know of no better answer to Stiglitz than his own words. In an article called How to Prevent the Next Wall Street Crisis, he proposed a six-point program that was chock full of regulations and laws. And then he acknowledges at the end of the same article, these reforms will not guarantee that we will not have another crisis. So why is the article called How to Prevent the Next Wall Street Crisis? Okay. Then Stiglitz explains why there's no guarantee here. The ingenuity of those in the financial markets is impressive. Eventually, they will figure out how to circumvent whatever regulations are imposed. Yep. So why the six-point program? Okay. And then he says, but these reforms will make another crisis of this kind less likely, and should it occur, make it less severe than it otherwise would be. I just don't get this at all. Okay. If the financial markets will eventually circumvent whatever regulations are imposed, then why is it another crisis equally likely with these regulations as without them? And why won't it be as severe with them as without them? The most that I think he could probably get away with saying is it might delay the crisis a bit. I don't know. This is one of the best minds in the world today. I just don't know. Finally, I want to say a few words about the significance of the various government interventions we've seen this year. The government's forced dismantling of Bear Stearns, nationalization of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the AIG, the bailout money that's being used to partially nationalize the banking system. Some commentators are portraying this, as I noted, as an effort to make the rich richer. Others are depicting it as some kind of a progressive turn, sort of an ideological shift away from the free market. I think that both notions are seriously mistaken. I think that what we're witnessing is a new manifestation of state capitalism. I'm not the only one saying that. It isn't the state capitalism of the former USSR that I'm talking about, where we've got central planning and the dominance of state property. It's state capitalism in the sense in which Raya Dunevskaya, founder of Marxist humanism, used the term to refer to a new global stage of capitalism characterized by permanent state intervention, which arose in the 1930s, and that was partly like the New Deal and the co-prosperity sphere a bit later in Japan. So it's not, state property is against private property as such, but permanent state intervention in the economy. And the purpose of the New Deal, keep in mind, just like that of the latest government interventions, is to save the capitalist system, or was to save the capitalist system from itself. And that's what's going on. They're trying to save capitalism from itself here. Now, many liberal and left commentators choose to focus on the distributional implications. Who's the government going to rescue? Rich investors and lenders, or average homeowners facing foreclosure? So when I say save the capitalist system, I want to point out that I mean this in the literal sense. What's going on, these interventions by the government, they're not taking place to make the rich richer or even to protect the wealth of the rich. They're meant to save the system itself. Okay. Consider the takeover of Bear Stearns, back in March. Bear Stearns was in serious trouble, but there were other ways of dealing with that trouble than by forcing it to be sold to J.P. Morgan Chase. Had Bear Stearns been allowed to borrow from the Fed, like everybody's doing now, it could have overcome the cash flow problem it faced, and that's all it was at the time. But the Fed waited until the following day, literally, to announce that it would now lend to Wall Street firms. Bear Stearns didn't get that privilege. Or if Bear Stearns had been allowed to file for bankruptcy, it could have continued to operate, and its owners' shares of stock would not have been sold off at a fraction of their market value. But the Fed forced it to be sold off. Okay. So the takeover was definitely not a way of bailing out Bear Stearns' owners. This is not making the rich richer, nor was the Fed trying to enrich the owners of J.P. Morgan Chase. The Fed selected J.P. Morgan Chase to take over Bear Stearns because it was the only firm big enough to do so in the financial sector. The Fed was acting to send a clear signal to the financial world that the U.S. government would do whatever it could to prevent the failure of any institution that is so-called too big to fail, because that could bring the financial system crashing down. They're trying to save the system, not put money in anybody's pockets. So consider also the government's rescue of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It came about because of a sharp decline in their share prices, you know, stock prices, but the government didn't rescue them in order to prop up the price of their stocks. Their share prices continued to decline after the rescue plan was announced, and for very good reason, because the government's motivation was not to bail out the shareholders, the owners of Fannie and Freddie. Indeed, the shareholders are not receiving any money from the government. Okay. Only the institutions and investors that lent to these institutions are being compensated for their losses, and the government had been seriously considering not compensating even some of these lenders, some of the institutions and so forth to which these firms owed money. The holders of subordinated debt were in danger of not being paid back, you know, under a government plan. So just as in the Bear Stearns case, the point of the intervention was to restore confidence in the financial system by assuring lenders that if all else fails, the U.S. government will be there to pay back the monies that are owed to them. Okay. So the new manifestation of state capitalism that we're seeing, it's essentially, I think, non-ideological in character. Okay. We do not have an ideological shift away from the free market. Henry Paulson, Treasury Secretary, this man is certainly no champion of government regulation or nationalization. But at this moment of acute systemic crisis, ideological scruples simply have to be set aside. This is not an ideological matter. The be-all and end-all priority is to serve the interests of capitalism. And I mean, capitalism itself is distinct from the capitalists, again. As Karl Marx noted, quote, "The capitalist functions only as capital personified, capital given, a human shape and a face. Capitalist functions only as capital personified. The rule of the capitalist over the worker is actually the rule of the object, capital, over the human. The rule of the product, capital, over the producer." Close quote. So the goal is the continued self-expansion of capital. That's what capitalism is, the self-expansion of capital when everything goes right. Yeah. Value that begets value in order to beget more value. Accumulation of value for the sake of accumulation of value, not for the sake of the consumption of the rich. That's what the system is all about, and that's what it means to be saving the system. Saving this driving force of accumulation of value for the sake of more and more and more and more of it, for its own sake. Now, of course, there is a movement away from free market capitalism for pragmatic reasons, towards more government control and even temporary ownership by the government. But again, it's just a matter of what they have to do to save the system. And there's nothing inherently progressive about it. This government's simply doing what it must, whatever it must, and they're trying everything to prevent a collapse of the system. I would suggest that the recent state capitalist interventions are best described as the latest phase of what Marx called, quote, "the abolition of the capitalist mode of production within the capitalist mode of production." You know, it's sort of self-negating and self-abolishing. In other words, there's nothing private about the system anymore. We don't have a private economy. The only thing that's private these days is the titles to property remain private, mostly. The government is not even intervening on behalf of private interests. It's intervening on behalf of the system itself. Bear Stearns owners, they can go to hell. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac owners, they can go to hell. The government is not concerned with them at all. They're trying to save a system. Okay. So they're not even trying to save, they're not even concerned with the interests of the rich. And such total alienation of an economic system from human interests of any kind is a really clear sign that it needs to perish and give way to a higher social order. Such a total alienation of a system from humanity that they don't even care about the interests of the rich anymore. They're just trying to save the system as an end in itself. So the current economic crisis is bringing misery to tens of millions, of course, of working people, but it's also bringing us a new opportunity to get rid of a system that's continually rocked by such crises. The financial crisis has caused so much panic that the fundamental instability of capitalism is being acknowledged openly on the front pages and the op-ed columns of leading newspapers. This was on the front page of today's Business Day in the New York Times. Columnist says, the LIBOR rates, the bank-to-bank lending rate, have crept down in recent days, greasing the wheels of capitalism, or at least what's left of it. So this is being openly acknowledged that the system is, you know, on the line here. Great numbers of people are searching for an explanation of what's gone wrong. Got a big turnout tonight. Many people might be ready to consider a wholly different way of life. Many more will be ready to consider this as the recession and the real economy deepens. Revolutionary socialists need to be prepared, and not just prepared with slogans, not just prepared to organize or talk about greed, but prepared with a clear understanding of how capitalism works and why it cannot be made to work for the vast majority. And we need to get serious about working out how an alternative to capitalism, an alternative that's not just another kind of capitalism, might be a real possibility. So I hope we can have some discussion that can move us forward. Thank you.
Okay, I'll open the floor to questions.
And comments.
How long do we have the...
We should wind up by 9:15 because we have to be totally out by 9:30.
Okay.
And we should save some time for people to look at Andrew's book and pamphlet and some of the works he alluded to are on the back table there by Donayevsky.
Oh, no, behind you, Alex. Sorry. I'll get you there.
You mentioned a bit about the sort of bubble economy that's happened past the late 70s. And it seems it's fair to anticipate a kind of populist push for regulation, at least in financial markets. But the question that's on my mind is if this push seems to be coming from within the ruling class itself. And if that goes through, then exactly what source of growth will come about to sort of move the economy? Because most of the growth that seems to have occurred in the last 30 years has been through speculation. So if you can't speculate anymore, then what do you do? And then the question of, you know, is the sort of energy economy, you know, is that a real possibility? And if it is, then what does that mean?
Do you want to answer them one at a time?
Let me ask, would people prefer that we have several comments and questions and then I respond, or do it one by one?
One by one.
Okay.
Okay.
You mean by energy economy a green economy or one that invests in energy products, building new technologies?
The reason I'm saying that is because that would seem, even though maybe an Obama administration might actually try and that it could open up opportunities if it's a reindustrialization.
Right. I mean, my basic view of that latter part is, there are investment opportunities when there's a sort of new technology, a new industry, but it's always replacing something. It's a zero-sum game. The investment is, they want to invest, okay? So they invest here and not there. Fundamentally, I think that's basically what goes on. So the question of investment opportunities is really a question of the phase of capitalism. Is it a boom? Is it not a boom? And so forth. your question is, if they're going to re-regulate the economy or try to do so, this is coming from within the ruling class, what sources of growth will there be? I think this is not really a question. I think it's a point, and I think it's pretty much a valid point. Compare, for instance, the United States to Europe. What has taken place in Europe for the past several decades is often termed sclerosis. They've still maintained a lot more regulation, less, quote, flexibility, you know, smashing of unions, and so forth. These regulations just impede the animal spirits of investment and the opportunities for quick profit. They might be trying this for a while, and I think right now they would be overjoyed to have a much more sluggish economy, but stable economy, but it's not going to last. Okay, this is the other thing I want to say about regulation. You know, like Stiglitz said, they're going to find a way around any regulation. And everybody's blaming the Republicans and the anti-regulation people and so forth. But think back, I don't know if you can think back, to the savings and loan crisis. That is sometimes called a crisis brought about by deregulation. It's not. It's a crisis that was brought about by regulation. The savings and loan industry used to just make home mortgages, and the commercial banks and investment banks didn't get involved. And the savings and loan industry was known as a 363 industry. You borrow funds at 3%, you lend them out at 6%, and you're on the golf course by 3 in the afternoon. But it was very safe. This is what a, you know, heavily regulated industry is. You know, there's just not much opportunity there. Okay. But then what happened was the inflation, double-digit inflation in the 1970s. And, you know, you've got your money there, savings as a deposit or in a savings and loan, and you're getting 3% interest, and the rate of inflation is 13%, so you're losing 10% a year. You don't want that. So these money market mutual funds crop up, and they're not regulated. And just to protect your savings, you're not some rich, greedy speculator. You're just trying to protect yourself from inflation. And so these money market mutual funds take off. Okay. Now, the money's starting to flow out of the savings and loan into the money market mutual funds. So to let the savings and loans compete, the government starts to do things to, you know, let them pay more for the deposits that they're bringing in. And if that's happening, then they have to allow them to engage in kind of more risky lending. Because if you're bringing in 6% on the mortgages and you're having to pay 8% interest on the deposits, you're losing money. So this is how it all developed. It did not come about through a deregulated environment initially. It came about through a regulated environment. Okay. The Keynesian economists, you know, who talk about all this, they don't talk about how they're going to stop, you know, the stagflation of the 1970s, which they weren't able to stop, despite all that regulation.
Alex, and then you.
I want to thank you, Andrew, for presenting such a marvelous analysis from a Marxist point of view of this crisis. And I would hope to
see... Well, thank you, Alex, for saying that.
And I would hope to see a lot more of this. Unfortunately, you're in a minority, as you know. Those who are, call themselves Marxist economists generally, when they present an analysis of this crisis, present something that's not a Marxist analysis. For instance, Rick Wolf, who is a Marxist economist, was interviewed on WBI radio the other day. I don't know if you heard this. And he said that this crisis leads us back to fundamental issues, and the fundamental issue is the issue of Keynesian economics. So we get from a so-called Marxist economist a Keynesian understanding of this present crisis. So how do we break through that kind of a logjam? And I would say that's probably the case with, what, 90, 95% of those who call themselves Marxist economists?
Well, I'm not a Marxist economist. They they, I don't like the Marxist economists. I mean, to me, Marxist economics is kind of like military justice or jumbo shrimp, you know. I think what we have to do is to take back Marxism from them. And I think they've, you know, used Marx for their own purposes by and large. And I could go into a lot of stories about this. You know, that doesn't mean we can ignore economic reality. I mean, too much of what's gone on in the last 20 years is talking about everything but the realities of economics and then trying to pick that up by the seat of our pants. We got to get educated. We got to get real. So what I think it's vital to try to reclaim Marx's critique of political economy, you know, for people who seriously want to change the world. And one thing that the Marxist economists have done is to keep perpetuating this notion that Marx's value theory is internally inconsistent. And I know this sounds like it's, you know, abstruse, but the point is an internally inconsistent theory cannot be true no matter how well it seems to explain what's going on. So you can just ignore it and move elsewhere. And so I've devoted a lot of my time for a couple of decades to fighting that notion, and that's what this book is about. You know, the subtitle is A Refutation of the Myth of Inconsistency, and it is tilted exactly against that, which has been perpetuated above all in the last 30 years or so by people who call themselves Marxist economists. So, you know, I'm doing my bit, and I really think that we need to reclaim Marx. It's very hard to justify that to people who don't know Marx. But one reason you don't know Marx is because of this kind of, like, you know, you have Marxist economists, and they tell you about Keynes. So if you could, like, for instance, look at this book and maybe, you know, put a review on Amazon or something.
Yeah, I like so much of what you said, particularly the introduction of state capitalism into the analysis. So I don't want to cough, but I do want to make three points, or ask you about three points. One, you said this is a bailout of the system, not of banks or the rich. And I basically agree with that. But part of the bailout of the system, I think, involves the decision of the state, of the Fed and the Treasury, to pick and choose which banks to support and which banks to consolidate, so that what we see is a process of centralization of capital. And certainly one of the choices of a bank to be a winner was Goldman Sachs. No surprise, Bob Rubin is an old Goldman Sachs man, and he's Obama's key economic advisor. Another winner was the Bank of America, the Wachovia deal. And there will be others. In other words, it seems to me that the government is choosing which banks will survive in this concentration and centralization process. Will they be formally nationalized? Probably not. Are they being statified? In effect, yes. The second point I would like you to comment on is this. I don't see this crisis, unless it gets to the point where you had your warlords, fascists, et cetera, scenario. We can talk about that later. I don't see it reversing the tendency to globalization. I think it reverses the tendency to neoliberalism that we've had over the past couple of decades, but not globalization, because as you said, one of the key effects of globalization is to reduce the cost of variable capital. Without those cheap consumer goods from China, Vietnam, Latin America, including the leftist regimes in Latin America, you cannot push down the wages of the American worker, or you get the American worker rising up, and the same with the European worker. The interdependence of a globalized system means we need to keep those Chinese factories super exploiting those Chinese workers sending those cheap consumer goods to the United States. And of course, the Chinese ruling class is more than willing to cooperate and to break the backs of Chinese workers, as it's been doing first under Mao for other reasons, and now under the present leadership in a globalized world. So I would like to hear whether you see that as an important factor. And the third thing is, I wonder if in the dead of night, tonight, we ask ourselves, are we going to vote for Obama? I don't want to answer the question. I hope not too. Because it seems to me that if you have to pick which political party can do the best job of saving the system, not saving the rich, but saving the system, it is clearly Obama and the Democrats. And I think that, as in the case of Roosevelt and the New Deal, this is really where capital has to put its metaphorical money. And it is banking, no pun intended, I think, on an Obama victory, which would be screwed up because there is a latent racism, and that could be played upon in the waning days of the campaign, deliberately, inadvertently, or whatever, by the McCain folks. But my hunch is capital has chosen its man for the White House for the next 4 years, and that man is Barack Obama.
I'm going to be brief with a couple of these things because, three questions. Try to keep it one piece.
Okay.
But with respect to the second thing, I don't think I said, if I did, I apologize, that there would be a reversal of the tendency to globalization. What I think I said is that the present crisis might be the one that fully destroys sufficient capital to lead to the next boom. On Obama and his chances of victory and all that, I have no expertise in that area, but I just want to share something. As you may know, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, two days ago, he endorsed the idea of the additional stimulus plan that the Democrats are putting forward. And the Wall Street Journal is incensed as hell about this. They said that what it is tantamount to is Bernanke, Colin Powell, endorsing Obama for president. So there is something, I think, to be said about that. So I think you're probably right there. Now, on the bailout of the system, and it's not a bailout, intended to enrich the rich. They are picking and choosing. It's hard to know, but I think that they are chastened as a result of the consequences of letting Lehman Brothers fail. Okay, they decided to let Lehman Brothers fail. Was that picking and choosing on the basis of we like this, we don't like that? I think they were picking and choosing because they didn't want to have to say, we're going to pick up the bill for everything in this goddamn country and world, come what may. And I think that they probably felt that Lehman was not too big to fail. I think that they were shown otherwise because of the reaction to that. Now, the official line is they did not have the legal powers to take over Lehman. I just don't know about that. So I think that they are picking and choosing, but I think it is according to certain principles that are governed by the effort to save the system. I forgot where I read this, but I think it was somebody talking about hearsay, from somebody in the Treasury, off the record comment that what they're going to be encouraging is further bank centralization. So a lot of the banks, they want to fail. Well, which are the ones that they want to fail and or not fail, but be bought up by other ones? They want the stronger and healthier banks to acquire the ones that are less so. So there's a principle to that, and they're again trying to save the system. It's not just, I'm going to bail out my cronies at Goldman Sachs.
If we're not here to bail out capitalism, I would hope we were here to see how we're going to make a revolution. And I don't hear any suggestions, I don't hear any ideas about what that would be. And that's what I was hoping. This is the greatest opportunity for a movement to grow, to be organizing and to be fighting. And there's a vacuum all over. And I was hoping tonight, not only would I hear maybe a little analysis, but I would also hear some hope and some ideas of about what's necessary, and you didn't say anything. I was hoping, what would you say as a response to that? Otherwise, why, I mean, just so that we know, we understand better what's going on, to me that's not enough. That's a mistake. We have a responsibility and an obligation today, based on what's been going on, to really begin to do something. I'm sure we've all been around, we've all been in movements, but today is a new day, in a sense. And the question is, what are we going to do about that?
I mean, I agree with you that just understanding is not enough. On the other hand, organizing, sloganeering, and all that is not enough either. And there has been a continual problem of, you know, that relationship of ideas and activity just coming apart, because it's always easier to organize on a populist basis of, you know, the greedy rich, and we don't need this bailout, $700 billion. It's always easier to organize on some basis other than one informed by theory analysis and philosophy. So I am trying here to do what I can on the basis of something about which I have expertise. I don't have a great deal of expertise about a lot of things, including organizing. And so my ideas, I don't think, are particularly something that I should burden you with, like I have all the answers to that. What I do think is crucially important is that people begin to understand who Mr. Big is. Mr. Big is not a Mr. or a Mrs. or a Ms. Mr. Big is the system itself, and what we have seen in the past month is, you know, just a lot of rhetoric and ideology trying to find scapegoats and place the blame on a particular person here or a particular, you know, institution there, or so forth and so on. Okay, the first thing that we're going to need if we really want to change this system is to understand what it means to say that we have a system. Okay. So you can't just say, oh, well, you know, the Fed takes over the banks. There are consequences to that, and they have to be thought out. Because it's incredibly responsible just to say, take over the banks. You know, if you're talking about expropriation without compensation, the capitalists of this world are going to be there ready to say, the hell with you, we're not going to have anything to do with you. Okay. And then what happens, and you have to be prepared for that. Okay. We live in a society where people think that political power is everything, and passing laws is everything. And that is not the case. Okay. So we really need to think these things through. I agree that's not all we need, but when activity becomes, you know, divorced from this, we go in the wrong direction. So I, again, have been trying to do what I can. It's the kind of contribution that I can make. And I'm not saying it's all we need, but I do think that any kind of attempts to organize that break away from trying to understand what the system is, how it works, and why it can't be made to work for the vast majority is fundamentally misguided or worse.
The first question is, you talk about this crisis going back to the 70s. So just a clarification, are you saying that the profit rates after the 1970s under neoliberalism never recovered the level they had before the crisis of the 70s? And the second question has to do with, you know, there was the big bailout with $700 billion, which involved buying bad assets, and then everybody was saying that we need this, it will save the system requires it, and so on and so forth. And then this passed, and nothing happened, and people said, well, this did not work, this would not work. It was like a weird change within a week. And then everybody said, well, what we really need these sort of capital injections, which is the partial nationalization. And it does seem to me that if that's true, if that's what is needed, is was needed was capital injection, the fact that you had this $700 million to begin with is something that perhaps was gratuitous in a way, and it was a way of redistributing wealth. It seems like, yes, perhaps they were trying to save capitalism, but they tried to select. I mean, there's sort of different ways of trying to save it. People have talked about the way the UK went, you know, about doing it as opposed to the US. And it seemed in the US they tried to follow the steps that would achieve the maximum redistribution possible for the sake of financial interests.
Okay, that was two questions. The first one has to do with what is the empirical basis on which I say that the world economy never fully recovered from the crisis of the 70s. You mentioned rates of profit. That's one bit of it. I don't put a lot of stock in the measures of rate of profit that the leftist economists put out, because they're based on like the Bureau of Economic Analysis data, and like when you have like these institutions with losses and they lose money and they write down, that doesn't get subtracted from the loss from the profits as the BEA counts them. So the rates of profit based on that are rather screwy and hard to analyze. So I look partly at that. I look at rates of growth. Okay, rates of growth have come down. There are other things as well. So it's a general assessment based on the fact that there was a post-World War II boom that lasted until about 1973, and then we just have not had a situation like that that has lasted any length of time. We had that temporarily under Clinton, the dot-com bubble, and so forth. As to the other thing, they came up with a $700 billion plan, and it was not very well fleshed out. And they said, "Oh well, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to do it this way." I don't know that they really had a fixed plan in mind. It's very hard to interpret this. Let me just say, for me, it's been very hard to interpret the events of the past month, because it would be a full-time job just to read what I need to read, and I already have a full-time job. So I don't want to try to over-interpret the thing of the last month. But I would say this, that the plan that is coming down now is internationally coordinated and is basically following the British model of partial nationalization. What you have to grapple with when you talk about this is being done to maximize, in a way that maximizes the gain of certain institutions or the rich, is there is a crisis of confidence. Confidence that loans are going to be repaid. And as long as you want a capitalist system, you do not say, okay, we're going to solve this by, expropriating without compensation. If you want to say that, talk about an alternative to capitalism. If you want to save the capitalist system, you have to do things that are not going to spook the capitalists. And not because there's a conspiracy, just because they're going to say, I'm not going to risk my money there. I'm not going to lend. And then GE doesn't have what it needs to produce, the stuff that it produces, and the workers don't have jobs, and the suppliers don't get their money, and they can't pay their debts, and so forth and so on. There are ramifications of all of that. Okay. So, yes, it's a capitalist system. People have to be, confident that they're going to get money back when they lend. That's the nature of the system.
You're in front.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. I'm part of a group called Internationalism. Some of you probably know us. Internationalism is a section of the ICC, International Communist Current, in the U.S. And we were invited to this meeting. We came before the other meeting with your group. First of all, I want to salute the presentation. I think it was quite good a presentation. And I want to express a total agreement in several of the points that the camera made. Just the dominant class through the government has no solution to this crisis. They talk about newspapers and magazines are full of data, full of facts, but there is no explanation of what is going on there. Nobody is saying us clearly this is the crisis of capitalism. It's a crisis, financial crisis. It is a product of greed, the product of the abuses. But it is not clearly, it is the work of revolutionary organizations to say this is the crisis, it's a crisis of capitalism and nothing else to start with. It is clear also that this is no a momentary moment in the life of capitalism. And the presenter made clear that this crisis has its roots, not only, of course, in the system itself, but we can see back to it since the 70s, since the end of the period of reconstruction coming out of the Second World War. There are many people who want to talk, so I'm gonna try to push this question. The second question, I think the presenter is totally right. The measures that right now the government is pushing forward are nothing else but state capitalist measures. They are not intended but to save the system from itself. They are measures intended to manage the crisis, nothing else. But the question is, the question we have to ask, and I think somebody on the back posed this question, do they have a solution to this crisis? Is the question that is posed, and I think that this is really the focus. We can spend, I think the economists and the newspapers spend a lot of time on trying to say what is the impact of the bailout, the impact of all the financial measures that the government has taken. But the question is this a solution? Do they have a solution to the crisis of capitalism? And I think from the point of view of the working class, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what they do. We know that in the last instance, what they are trying to do, it is to make the working class to pay for the crisis. In the last instance, what they are trying to do, it is to keep the system afloat. And what we are going to see, it is there is the working class that is going to pay for this crisis. And they are paying, we are paying already. We are paying with increased layoffs. We are paying with salaries that are going down. And the question it is slightly posed. The question is, what working class can do so to face the attacks of capitalism? And the answer is, the working class has to struggle to defend its own interests, in some terrain, in the terrain of the class struggle, in the factory, in the workplaces, against these attacks of capitalism. It is only that way that they can face the crisis.
Okay. I mean, I agree with most of what you said. You know, but it's not only a matter of shifting the burden. You know, they're trying to put the thing on the working class. There are a lot of capitalists who are suffering. Lehman, Bear Stearns. I mean, people have had their whole things wiped out. They don't like it either. Okay. The point is that they are just personifications of capital. They're just functionaries of the system, and they exist as long as they function for the sake of the system and not a moment longer as capitalists. So, you know, again, it's not the good people and the bad people or the rich or the poor. There's a system here. Some people generally do better than others, but it's an out-of-control system, And it's fundamentally an out-of-control system because it's not based upon and geared to humanity. Humanity serves the system instead of the opposite.
Okay.
So is there a solution to this crisis from within the capitalist framework? I mean, I agree that fundamentally right now what they're doing is not a solution. It's a papering over of debt with more debt. And that is what they have been doing, you know, systematically for decades now. And it often works very well. You know, debts go bad, you cover them with more debt, and they just keep doing that. Fundamentally, that's what this all boils down to. There is one solution to the crisis from the capitalist standpoint, though, and that is a sufficient destruction of capital through financial measures, you know, depression and so forth, or through war, like we saw in World War II, sufficient destruction of capital so that the profit that is there is very, very big in relationship to what you need to invest. Okay, so they can always bounce back. A guy I like to quote a lot, who I've quoted several times tonight, Karl Marx said, there is no such thing as a permanent crisis. Okay. There's no permanent crisis in capital. Okay. Because the measures, not the measures, the things that happen in the crisis are what lead to the boom. The destruction of capital value, and in physical terms, that destruction, which is the manifestation, you know, of all of what's gone wrong, that is what leads to the new boom. So there can always be a new boom. There's nothing automatic about the collapse of capitalism. It's going to take thought, it's going to take organization, a lot of things. They can always bounce back, and give it enough destruction. They will, unless the whole thing collapses because of, you know, financial panic, such as was developing until recently, and maybe now it's subsiding somewhat.
So if there is no permanent crisis, that means there's no new epoch, and that what we see is a repetition of tragedy as farce, to paraphrase Marx from the 18th of America, and that we shouldn't have this temptation, this populist messianic romantic temptation that this is the crisis now, and it's going to be this new epoch of state capitalism, which just wants to either drown us in barbarism or will open up a new horizon of socialist revolution. And what we need to do, instead of going out into the streets with microphones, is we need to go back and hit the books, really. But I thought you gave an excellent analysis. I'm just a little skeptical about some terminology. I think it has to really do with Stalin, and that even before Ray and Dostoevsky, you had Leon Trotsky and his preface to Capital Marxism in Our Time talking about the same trends in the Roosevelt administration. So what really is the difference here? And if capitalism can bounce back and it can usher in a new monetarist reign as opposed to this neo-Keynesianism we're seeing now, why do we need a totally new conceptual apparatus, a totally new epoch of state capitalism to explain this if it does bear semblance to what happened in the 1930s?
I did not say that we're in a new epoch of state capitalism, for God's sakes. No. This is not a new epoch. This is a moment of crisis. And I would not say that state capitalism was ever an epoch. It's a stage of capitalism, but it is a continuation of a fundamental tendency all throughout capitalism, you know, from competitive capitalism to imperialism, the monopoly stage of capitalism, through to state capitalism, that is the centralization and concentration of capital. Capital getting bigger and fewer hands. And in the work Capital, we're talking a lot about capital, but the book Capital, Marx said in any given society, the limit to this centralization and concentration would be reached in a given society if the total capital of that society were in the hands of one capitalist or one capitalist company.
Isn't it
And you know, because there are power issues involved, and we see the need for power at a very centralized level when things get out of hand to coordinate the system, that one single capital, you know, has at times been the state. But I'm not talking about, you know, state property here or planning. I'm talking about permanent state intervention. That's what we saw with the New Deal, prosperity sphere in Japan. Now, I don't want to get heavily into theoretical disputes here, but Leon Trotsky understood that you could have state capitalism. What happened, however, is he got into this mess where, because there had been nationalized property taken over, you know, through a socialist kind of revolution, workers' revolution, he deemed that not capitalist. Okay, and other people have just had this idea, you know, if it's state, it's not capitalist. If it's private, it is capitalist. I think that that way of thinking has just shown its bankruptcy, to use the term bankruptcy, in the latest crisis. Okay, it's just not tenable. Okay, you know, at one point Marx talked about the state, and he said the state is the executive committee of the bourgeoisie. You know, it's the governing power that coordinates them all together, because they've got conflicting interests, but, you know, when push comes to shove, they've got to act, you know, for the benefit of the system. So that's what I think is going on right now. It's the state that is acting as the executive committee of the whole bourgeoisie, and is constraining the private capitalists who don't really like it, but they're so scared, you know, they're quaking in their boots right now. So they submit to it.
Over here.
Sorry,
goodbye. I also agree with the analysis and with the idea of spreading the understanding that this crisis is not caused by bad leadership or lack of regulation, but this crisis of the system itself is in itself a contribution revolutionary struggle. I have a few questions.
Can you limit it to one? Just as other people.
Okay. It's about the immediate economic future. This crisis of confidence has been preceded by a crisis of confidence in other capitals in the periphery. Like 10 years ago, and since that happened, the flow of capital into the US economy has increased a lot, according to Stephen Roach of Morgan Stanley. 80% of the net savings of the world flowed in this decade to the US economy. So the question is, after this has happened, where are these savings going to go to? You know, the world economy has basically been kept humming by this mechanism in which the US economy consumes more than it produces, and its debt is being bought up by Asian economies and so on, and this triangular situation goes on. With all that has happened now, can this continue? Is there a possible alternative for this relationship, and where could savings and accordingly flow to?
Can you show the 4-week Treasury paper graph again? Yeah. Just ratchet up to this one. You know, I don't know, and I should say this about economics. The public hears economists forecasting and making predictions. But there is nothing in economics as a discipline that lends itself to that. People learn some ability to, some techniques to do statistical estimation, but economic theory is not fundamentally predictive. So anybody who gets up there is doing it, sort of on their own without a big body of theory behind them. And forecasters, forecasting doesn't really work all that well 3 months, 6 months down the line, but after 2 years, nobody can forecast. And anybody who ever said there was going to be a crisis because of a buildup of debt is now saying, I predicted this. Dr. Gloom, Rubini, he's now the guy. I don't think he predicted this. I think he predicted problems as a result of the current account deficit. It's a near miss. So I don't want to predict, but I want to say this. I think that we've heard a lot about, after a point, all the foreign money that is buying up the U.S. government debt is going to leave because of the weakness of the United States. Okay, but look at this. In a time of risk, in a time of crisis, what the capitalists are telling us is that the safest investment in the world is the U.S. Treasury. At the moment when the U.S. is in severe crisis, the government doesn't know what it's doing, obviously. They're trying things out. You've got a lame duck president who's a lame ass president, okay? And the whole rest of it, tremendous uncertainty because of the election. People are willing to park their money in short-term treasury paper and get almost nothing for it. It's very paradoxical that the greater the risk, relatively speaking, the less is the risk of the United States to the state. Now, they're borrowing, it looks like, a hell of a lot of money. I don't know exactly how this is all going to work, because a lot of it's coming from the Fed rather than the Treasury. But eventually, if they do have to borrow, like crazy, and they're not going to raise taxes to cover $700 million, by the way. They're going to borrow, right?
Billion,
whatever. Okay, so eventually there is going to be real concern about whether the U.S. government can pay back its debts. There will be eventually that. If it comes down to that kind of a situation, that could develop. They could always sort of just throw monopoly money into the economy, but then your returns are being eroded because the money's not buying what it used to. There are some concerns about that already. As a result of all of these kinds of things, the current account deficit, the explosion of the federal debt, and all kinds of things. I don't crystal ball gaze very well, so I want to just leave it at that.
You use the concept about confidence and the lack of confidence. My question about that is, politically, doesn't that have huge significance in terms of a type of regime coming in that can instill perhaps a false confidence? That's question number one. And number two is, you use the word also humanity. I think that that's what you said in terms of establishing the value of something. Could you explain that one?
What did you say might be instilling a false confidence?
Politically, isn't that the basis for fascism or a severe type of government coming in?
Right.
There is economic lack of confidence.
Right. To some extent, the larger political environment, obviously matters here. But when we talk about a crisis of confidence, we're really thinking of something very mundane, that's not disconnected from that, but the confidence is not just an overall confidence, in the system, or it's a confidence that you're going to get the money back that you lent. You know, are you confident that you lend and you're going to get back what's due you? And I use the term humanity, well, basically the system of value production, you know, or capital is, capital is self-expanding value. They invest a sum of value in order to get back a bigger sum of value, and not in order to eat it, fundamentally, because they got to grow in order to compete, so they reinvest it, and so you have the growth of capital as value for the sake of its own self-expansion. It's an end in itself. Okay, it is its own goal. It's not there to serve anything else but itself, so to speak. And people are at the service of the system. You know, of course, the workers are at the service of the system, but the capitalists are at the service of the system too. And they're just functionaries of the system. The system is not benefiting a hell of a lot of them very, you know, anymore right now. You know, yeah, Goldman Sachs, but what about all the people that, again, lost their money in Bear Stearns and investing in Fannie and Freddie and, you know, Lehman and so forth. So they're there to serve the system, and only insofar as they are actually increasing value, you know, do their companies survive, and do they survive as functionaries at the head of the system? So it's a totally alienated system. It's alienated from human interest of any kind.
How would that be different under socialism?
Well, the purpose, you know, if you really have a socialist society, I mean, you might be asking, how would we really have socialism? But the whole purpose of a socialist society would be a society that is one in which human self-development, so that's an end in itself. Okay, human power and its development as an end in itself. And not excluding anybody. I think it's in the Communist Manifesto. The slogan is, the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the goal.
It's basically also in capital.
It's basically also in capital.
And critique of the
Gothic Purge. Okay, we have a lot of scholars here, yeah.
In the back and then Mark.
Yes, could you comment on the relation of the Chinese system and what it has to do with this rescue effort? I'm particularly thinking of the fact that their banks, unlike many others in the so-called developed world, were not allowed to get involved with these mortgage-backed securities, derivatives, and the like. And beyond that, their relationship to, their whole interrelationship with us at this point, and what effect it could have on this effort in the long run. I know you don't want to forget, but let's talk about what it has been so far.
Let me see if anybody else can comment on that, because I can't. I just don't know. I'm sorry.
I just think that the Chinese are holding a mountain of this toxic debt which has been pawned off onto them. I don't think it's true that Chinese banks, sovereign funds, haven't invested heavily and aren't as deeply involved in that this financial crisis isn't going to affect their banking system as it will the banking system of virtually every country. So I question the statement that the Chinese are not involved.
I didn't make a statement. I asked a question.
Oh, okay. I thought you said the Chinese banks were not allowed to.
They aren't.
But I don't.
That's part of the question. And they haven't been buying into the mortgage-backed securities and derivatives and the things that brought down a small town in Norway that was buying into these. Their pension plan was sent down the drain. So, you know, that's another aspect. This crisis is a little strange, if I can use that word, compared to the Depression of the 1930s.
If you could talk about great talk though, and this is really nice. I was wondering if you could talk about to what degree this crisis comes out of capitalism as opposed to simply being an effect of like monetary expansionist policies, and
over the last like 40 years, 30 years. And in relation to that, like what, you know, like a monetarist or like return to gold standard approach would to sort of talk about that. I mean, that's sort of another way of saving the capitalist system, right? But I don't know. But just getting back to the idea that why is this, or is this, does this come out of any sort of inherent contradiction of capitalism, or is this sort of a part of the management of expansion of the money supply? Does any of that make sense?
Let me try to rephrase it to see if I've got it. Is the current crisis a result of bad policies or a particular line of policy that is discretionary, mm-hmm. or is it stemming from fundamental contradictions of the system?
Yeah.
Well, it's definitely the latter, and I guess I didn't go into it enough. I'll just try again to recap it. Capitalism has a tendency of the rate of profit to fall that resolves itself in crisis. But the crisis is the resolution and the spur to a boom only insofar as capital is destroyed in value terms and physically. And we have not yet had in the world economy a sufficient destruction of capital to lead to a new boom. Since the crisis of the mid-70s, which kind of marked the end of the post-war boom period. So they don't want to repeat, they've never wanted a repeat of the Great Depression. Is that discretionary? I guess in a certain way, because even in this crisis, you've got the real hardline free marketeers saying, you know, the purge of capital, the purge of value, that's healthy, that's what we need to do, no bailout for that reason. And there's a good deal to be said for that, you know, from their point of view. Let the weak ones die and let the strong survive. You know, we might have a Great Depression, we could have God knows what happens, but, you know, if they come out of that, the strong would come out much stronger and there would be a boom. So I think that in a certain sense the policy has been, let's not have a Great Depression. Let's manage these difficulties. Let's prop up the system despite the fact, you know, that things are not going quite well, and pump it up. Okay, so pump it up with easy money, credit, all of that. And as I said, I think that the current crisis that we're now in is a response in particular to the weakness of the U.S. economy in this decade coming out of the dot-com bubble crash, the recession, 9/11. So they're continually just trying to keep the system up greater than the flow of new value from production allows, with debt and more debt and more debt, and so we have these bubbles.
But if you could get in touch on to what degree, because all the stuff that's out there is so focused on that stuff. Talk about to what degree, why is this a crisis that comes out of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall? And that's because Mark, I think that's what Mark Wolf was sort of beginning to, Ripple was starting to get at WBAI, and then he got distracted a little bit. But what's fundamentally going on here that's causing this?
I thought I just answered that. So it's the destruction of capital. Yeah. What?
Falling the margin of profits. Can you explain that a little more?
The falling rate of profit?
Yeah. Why that happens?
I actually can't because it would take too much time. But look, the point is not to look at the tendency, not to look at the actual trend in the rate of profit, to understand that there's a tendency for it to fall. This resolves itself in crisis, wherein a lot of capital value is destroyed, you know, all at once. But that is the mechanism for the regeneration of the system, the new boom. To the extent that that does not happen, to the extent that the system does not contract sufficiently, it does not expand then sufficiently, and in order to keep the system afloat without that huge boom, What they've been doing is they've been throwing debt after debt after debt. I could explain, you know, the whole scenario leading from the falling rate of profit tendency to crisis and so forth. It's just, I'm not prepared for that right now, and it would take a bit of time.
The woman over here.
You mentioned rating agencies, and you passed it off as just saying they made a mistake. It's inconceivable to me how rating agencies could have given a triple A ratings to this junk. I mean, to what extent did that contribute to this fiasco that's going on? How could something like that have happened? It seems almost conspiratorial. How could they close their eyes to this incomprehensible wisdom that was going on and give it a triple A ratings?
I don't know the full story. It's a good question. I don't know the full story.
It seems to me, when you talk about pension funds buying all these things, the institutional buyers and even the individual buyers are looking at ratings. They're depending on all of this. It seems to me that's
right.
Somewhere of all this crash. People are depending on agencies to tell them the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And they're...
Okay, look. The stuff is junk now. It's toxic now. Why is it toxic now? Because home prices have fallen, according to the Case-Shiller Index, by 19.5%. How were they able to predict that? If the home prices had fallen by 3%, this toxic junk would not have been toxic junk. You know, it would have legitimately had a triple A rating.
But no one can figure out what the worth of this stuff is, whether it's toxic or not.
Okay, that is a result of so much of the lending going bad, and you're trying to sort out the bad from the good. Okay, but here's the point. The rating agencies have to use models. They have to make certain assumptions about what will happen. So they have the best case scenario, the worst case scenario. Nobody thought, and they were wrong, nobody thought that home prices were going to collapse to the extent that they've done. If they had not collapsed, however, and as far as I know, this is the first real nationwide collapse of home prices since at least the Great Depression. Had those home prices not collapsed, we wouldn't have had this crisis.
So what came first? I mean, what caused the home prices?
They were overvalued relative to the flow of income that could pay these mortgages. I mean, a lot of it was risky stuff. And so forth, and subprime, but the prices went skyrocketing in just the space of 5 years, you know, 6 years. The home prices doubled. Okay, how can the home prices double? Right? People have mortgages; they have to pay the mortgages. Their incomes haven't doubled. That's fundamentally what's going on.
So. From sort of an orthodox reading of Marx, I guess he classified the crisis into two like main categories: the tendency of the profit rate to decline and the overproduction or underconsumption crisis. So my question is: this current crisis is in line with which of these two, or like a mixture of two? Because intuitively, I was thinking that this basically chronic sort of debt crisis is more a manifestation of decline of rate of profits, and this bubble bursting is more like underproduction or overproduction, underconsumption. But I have the feeling that this current crisis is more like an underproduction because the amount of real production is less than the speculations.
Okay. The question was about, I don't know if everybody could hear it, is this a falling rate of profit-based crisis or overproduction under consumption crisis? I don't believe in the idea of an underproduction overconsumption crisis. When there is a crisis, there is overproduction. I mean, that's what a crisis is, but it's not an explanation. And as far as under consumption goes, I could talk all about that, but um, I don't think that really holds water from a theoretical standpoint. I don't think that's what's been happening. I mean, my analysis is that this is a result of the fundamental tendencies of values to decline through higher productivity, leading to a fall in the rate of profit, which eventually negates itself. The rate of profit doesn't fall forever. The tendency of the rate of profit to fall negates itself by means of a crash, okay? But the crash, you know, that we saw in the Great Depression and then the destruction of capital, you know, in World War II, that did not proceed to the same extent. You know, in the latest period, since the 70s, okay? And I mean, just look at what they did in Japan, okay? I mean, there was like incredible stagnation in Japan for like a decade as they were just trying to protect themselves from a slump. And that's a really classic case of what I'm talking about, trying to prevent the destruction of capital. They, you know, I don't know if they're going to try that here or now. So yeah, this is, it's ultimately stemming from the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, but there's a lot of mediations, there's a lot of intermediate links here. And people who talk about the falling rate of profit can also, by the way, mean many, many, many different things. So you got to hold on to your wallet for that, too.
Yeah. We have to wind up soon, so I'd like to address I can't remember who it was, the person who raised the what are we going to do about all this. This is a school, the new space. If you heard my rap in the beginning, it's a school that's attempting to actually work with revolutionary movements by developing revolutionary thought. So if you think that's important, then please make some proposals for next semester. We're not here just for your edification, and so you can go home smarter tonight and say, well, now I understand things. All right, we're here to try to help change the world through the development of ideas. So make us a proposal, and the proposal should not just be, you know, that we should have 5 sessions on this or something instead of 1, but it should be something, what can you do? Can you teach? Can you bring people, particularly can you bring workers or women and minority people? Can you get people interested in understanding Marx so that they see that there is some alternative? I've been running around to a lot of meetings on the economic crisis, and what the left is presenting on it, and to give us some examples, it's really pitiful. It's 20 years since, almost 20 years since the fall of communism, and the left still has no alternative to present. They're still in the mindset of, nationalized property is socialism, so that's good. So they're cheering for the, you know, more regulation, more nationalization, as if that was the way to get to socialism. The program last night with Naomi Klein and Stiglitz was pitiful. I don't know what else. Were other people there? He's trying to talk about the economy, and she's totally clueless. She's talking just about political power. Who has political power? So it's the same old thing. Well, if you have power, then you can give the money to the poor people instead of the rich people. And it's like totally has nothing to do with what's really going on in the world. But people like that because people are used to thinking that way. So what are we going to do to try to change that? Or even more long term, what are we going to do to try to save Marx from being completely forgotten? You know, that's one of the things Andrew's book addresses. It's not for the sake of Marx, it's for the sake of being able to see some alternative. People are not going to rise up and risk their lives fighting the system if they don't see any alternative. So I think the only way to see it is through studying Marx and seeing that in his thorough examination of capitalism, there is the opposite possibility, a different overproduction, a different way of life. And we need to talk about that. That seems to be the only thing the left should be doing. Not going out and saying, I'm going to lead the revolution and I'm going to organize the workers or something. No, workers got to organize themselves. But offering some education, some elucidation, and trying to work with people on theorizing what an alternative to capitalism would be. So I invite people to get involved.
One last question, comment.
I just wanted to say that the fundamental point that we agree with is the issue that capitalism has no more future to offer to humanity, and that if anything, this latest crisis gives a powerful tool to the working class to denounce the fact that capitalism is leading humanity towards a dead end. And I think that we can spend a lot of time discussing and deepening on the ultimate causes of the crisis, whether it's the fall of the rate of profit. Luxembourg has a different explanation that stays in the limitation of the foreign markets. We can go on and on deepening these details about explaining the crisis, but the fundamental point is, do we have a revolutionary theory? Do we think that capitalism has reached the point that Marx has said the fetter of further development of the productive forces? Do we have a basis, therefore, to think about a revolution? And I think the discussion about the crisis necessarily leads towards the perspective for humanity.
I agree mostly. I'll be very quick. Yeah, I agree mostly with what you said, but I don't think that the theory of why we have crises is just some abstruse issue that is independent of fighting for a future, organizing, and so forth. I'll just read what I've written. The law of the tendential fall of the rate of profit has revolutionary political implications because it suggests that economic crises stem from an internal contradiction of value production. Increases in physical productivity cause reductions in commodity values and a tendency for the rate of profit to fall that cannot be resolved within capitalism. So higher productivity leads to falling rate of profit. It's a real contradiction there. That cannot be resolved within capitalism, that tendency. In contrast, theories that trace crises to low productivity, sluggish demand, which is Luxembourg's theory, basically, competition, high wages, these suggest that capitalism's crisis tendencies can, in principle, be substantially lessened or eliminated. So I think that what seems like to many like an abstruse theoretical debate is actually a debate about this issue. Can capitalism's crisis tendencies be moderated, ameliorated, or eliminated within this system? I think that's the issue.
No, I was going to say he doesn't have to be brief, just like final comments. But thank you all for coming out. I invite you to look at the literature, space literature, there's literature back there, and keep in touch.
I assume you're talking about this.